From Austin to Richmond, state legislatures across the U.S. are taking aim at China. Bills in play would prevent Chinese land ownership, business investment, or grant money to American professors.
We see these, and like, you know, you just got to scratch your head, like, why?
I'm Marco Werman, also a Ukrainian soldier's daily reality on the front line. Exhaustion coupled with a determination to not give back any sliver of land.
Every inch of our territory is worth it.
And empty store shelves in Cuba. When goods do arrive, people hustle to be first in line.
You know, word of mouth spreads that there is chicken somewhere. Everybody goes there and buys chicken. You have to buy it for rainy days.
Plus, the country of Georgia was on the short list to join the European Union. Now the odds look much longer. We explain today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For the second straight day in Tbilisi, Georgia, massive protests, anger over a proposed law that would require organizations that receive funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. Georgia's dominant political party, Georgian Dream, is behind the new bill. The party has been accused of backsliding on democracy and putting at risk a push to join the European Union. From the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, Levi Bridges has our story.
Walking around Tbilisi, you could be forgiven for thinking that Georgia is already part of the European Union. You see the EU's iconic blue flag with a ring of golden stars everywhere, hanging from apartment windows or waving before government buildings.
Right now I'm wandering around through a children's amusement park, and even above the bumper cars, I see the European Union flag and the flag of Georgia flying against a gray winter sky.
One reason you see the flag so often is because Georgia is a member of the Council of Europe, a human rights organization, which also uses the EU flag. 65-year-old Benzina Tsutsumia runs the bumper cars here at the amusement park. For him, flying the EU flag is partially about identity. Tsutsumia says that Georgia stands at the crossroads between Europe and Asia. Turkey and Iran are south of Tbilisi, and Russia lies to the north. But many Georgians, like Tsutsumia, firmly see themselves as being a European people.
Europe is stability and a better life in the Soviet Union.
He says for him, Europe represents stability and progress. He says Georgia was closed off from the world when it was part of the Soviet Union. Joining the EU would mean opening up and becoming part of a more multicultural world that's not dominated by Russia. Georgia was once considered a favorite among countries seeking EU membership, but now that's changing. The government is dominated by a party called Georgian Dream that was founded by a Georgian billionaire named Bidzina Ivanishvili, who made a fortune in Russia back in the 90s. In recent years, Georgian Dream has been accused of not making needed improvements to the judiciary, decreasing freedom of the press, and failing to protect the rights of LGBTQ people.
And this is not the direction that a country that wants to be liberal and democratic should go.
Sonia Schiffers is the director of the Heinrich Böll Foundation's Tbilisi office, a think tank associated with the German Green Party. She says Georgia gets relatively good rankings from organizations like Transparency International on issues like corruption. The problem is that, unlike Ukraine, Georgia's government has stalled efforts to strengthen its democracy.
During the last couple of years, there had already been a downward trend in terms of democratic reforms and also anti-Western rhetoric, even from members of the ruling party.
Recently, some members of Georgian Dream have been openly hostile to American and EU officials. And other politicians formerly associated with Georgian Dream are accused of spreading anti-Western conspiracy theories.
We have a government which argues against the West, so it's a tragic moment.
Giga Bokaria is with the opposition party European Georgia. He wants Georgia to gain EU membership because it would make the country more secure at a time when Russia is invading its neighbors.
We need government at this historic stage who would be banging on the doors in Washington and Brussels, explaining why, both morally and pragmatically, Georgia should become part of the Western security architecture.
Hello.
Hello, Levi.
Deep inside the parliament, I meet Georgi Halashvili, a politician with Georgian Dream and the deputy chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. He says Georgia has made great sacrifices to become closer to the West, like sending troops to Afghanistan to collaborate with the U.S. and NATO.
Unfortunately, it is the West that has demonstrated hesitancy in coming closer to Georgia rather than the other way around.
Georgian Dream has also come under fire for not taking a harsh enough stance on Moscow since Russia invaded Ukraine. Halashvili says those criticisms are unfair.
When you have a nuclear superpower next to you, which is threatening and menacing you incessantly, how can we risk the livelihood and lives of our population just by challenging Russia?
But trying to appease both Russia and the West could become a national security issue, says Corneli Kakachia, director of the Tbilisi think tank, the Georgian Institute of Politics.
I think the problem is that Georgia cannot sit in two chairs at the same time. Russian leaders, they want to build kind of a new Russian empire where there's no Georgia as a separate nation. And if Ukraine will not prevail in this war, next target could be Georgia.
Georgia is still under consideration to become an EU member. But unless the government firmly embraces the West, like Ukraine has, Georgia's path to the EU will be much more complicated. For The World, Levi Bridges, Tbilisi, Georgia.
The Biden administration is considering adopting a highly controversial immigration tactic, once again detaining migrant families caught crossing the border illegally. That's something President Biden said he would not do. The Department of Homeland Security says no final decision has been made, but border restrictions enacted during the pandemic expire in May, and an increase of migrants is expected, leaving President Biden to look at a major shift in policy. The World's Tbilisi Zeya reports.
Shortly after beginning his term in office, President Biden ended the family detention policy. During the Trump administration, migrant families caught crossing the border illegally could be held for up to 20 days while authorities decided if they should be deported.
The Biden administration stopped family detention because it was cruel.
Adam Isaacson is a border security expert with the Washington Office on Latin America.
The idea of taking parents with children and holding them in a facility that looks a lot like a prison, where they cannot leave, simply seem to go against the values of, I'd say, most of the Democratic voter base.
There is also research that shows detentions can be traumatic, especially for children. And they're also expensive. Isaacson says they cost about $300 per family per day. But now the Biden administration is rethinking its border policies.
The idea here is to take at least some of these families and hold on to them. And that way, maybe news of families being detained and not let into the United States will travel via social media and fewer families may make the decision to come. That's what they're calculating.
But Isaacson says he doubts this strategy will work because there are too few spaces in detention centers, and more than 90% of migrants, according to Isaacson, will not be detained at all. Muzaffar Chishti is with the Migration Policy Institute. He says whatever the Biden administration decides, politics are playing a big role here.
Politics is central to immigration debate. It has never been more polarizing. The perception of a lack of control at the border is being used by the president's opposing party.
Another part of the Biden administration's strategy is a humanitarian parole. It allows people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to apply for work permits if they find a sponsor and pass a background check. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas told CNN it's been successful.
The individuals coming from those countries whom we encounter at our southern border has dropped more than 95%.
But that policy is now being challenged in court. As for migrant detentions, Mallorca says all options are on the table. But Muzaffar Chishti says detention is never a good idea. And if the aim is for people to show up at legal hearings, there are alternatives to detention.
Which is like carrying a cell phone which monitors you, or wearing a device which monitors your movements.
Activists, along with members of President Biden's own party, say migrant detention will not deter people from seeking asylum, and that fixing the asylum process is long overdue. For The World, I'm Tbilisi Zeya.
Two of the four Americans kidnapped in a Mexico border city last week have returned to the U.S. today. Two others were killed in Mexico. The group of friends from South Carolina went to Mexico seeking affordable medical treatment, medical tourism. It's believed they were kidnapped in a case of mistaken identity in the city of Matamoros, just south of Brownsville, Texas. Joining me from Mexico City is reporter Joan Grillo, who covers crime and guns in Mexico. He's the author of a new book called Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. Joan, what more do we know about the kidnapping incident that left two Americans dead last week? Who's believed to be behind this?
The evidence is pointing to the cartel which controls the city of Matamoros, where they were taken. It's called the Gulf Cartel. As this happened, there were various gunfights breaking out or shootings in Matamoros. One of the factors of the violence on this particular day was said to be fighting with Haitian migrants, or what are described as Haitian smuggling gangs. There's been a large number of Haitians that have particularly arrived in the city since last October. So the fact that they were fighting with Haitians could then lead to a confusion when they see some African Americans driving in a vehicle. Although often when you have these very chaotic situations of shootouts happening and gunmen driving around, you can just see any vehicle driving fast and people can start firing at it or block it and start taking people.
Is there an investigation still ongoing?
Yes, there is. There's been a call for justice from the United States. Now, in this case, there was pressure coming down. It appears, and this is kind of the case, when the authorities can then pressure and the cartel can simply release and kind of give up these people, rather than them being rescued in some kind of daring raid by the Mexican military. It seems like the survivors were just handed in. Now there's still pressure to investigate and to punish people for this, to bring justice. You know, we'll see what happens with that, and will there be some people who will be arrested and perhaps be extradited to the United States or face time in Mexico?
I mean, to that point, there has been some consternation that given the high number of kidnappings of Mexicans, especially in this part of Mexico, and the dead ends in those cases where victims are often not found, that these Americans were tracked down with relative urgency. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, you see this very starkly. There's, you know, records of more than 100,000 disappearances of Mexicans over the last 20 years. And many cases where people are taken by armed groups, sometimes by police officers or soldiers and handed to armed groups, or sometimes just directly by cartel members. But yeah, the tragedy is there's disappearances and murders every day here. There's an anger by people of saying, well, suddenly the government can work and get people released. In this case, how come they can't do it when it happened to my father or my son or my brother or my wife or my daughter?
Joan, bigger picture, how have Mexican authorities been dealing with the rising violence in the city of Matamoros overall? How much power do they have to stop gang activity?
So you have this sadly, a kind of modus operandi where the cartels are operating quite openly around the mobilization of large amounts of the military and federal security forces. And you see that now we could expect after this incident and the fact it's a diplomatic political incident, a crackdown in the city, a big military mobilization in the city. But I would still have doubts if this would lead to the cartel in the long term being taken out.
Your new book does get into how the U.S. tacitly contributes to cartel violence. Tell us briefly about that.
So my book is a multi-year investigation into the gun trafficking networks. And you see them going throughout the United States to arm the cartels in Mexico, to the level where over a decade, you see more than 2 million firearms being used by the cartels, which are coming from the United States, including, you know, not only AK-47s and AR-15s, but also weapons like 50 caliber rifles. We're firing these 50 cal bullets, and these used widely in Mexico and used in part of this violence.
Joan Grillo is a journalist reporting on crime and guns in Mexico. He's the author of Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels. He joined us from Mexico City. Joan, thank you very much.
Great to be here.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut is an elusive prize. Russian and Ukrainian forces have been battling for control of it for months. This week, the assessment from British defense intelligence officials is that Ukraine has stabilized its defensive perimeter around Bakhmut. Others claim the city could fall into Russian hands within days. 27-year-old Ukrainian corporal Andrei Shadrin is on the ground there. From time to time on the show, we've checked in with him. He serves in a military unit that repairs and replaces equipment damaged on the front lines.
Russians might have had some tactical successes, but the city is fully under the control of Ukrainian armed forces. And there is a supply line because we get there almost every day.
Now, as I said, your specialty is repairing equipment. How busy have you and your unit been lately? As a fighting around Bakhmut meant a lot of weaponry that needs your attention.
Well, frankly speaking, we've had a hell of a lot of a job because the character of combat going around the city made us pretty much unable to maneuver with the equipment. And most of our points with the equipment were identified, and now they're like a regular aim for the enemy. So we're having pretty much of a job, and it's kind of a race who is faster, us repairing the equipment or Russians destroying it or damaging it. So right now it's kind of a big hide-and-seek game.
Mm. You also, I imagine, have to triage the equipment. What happens to massive pieces of weaponry that are destroyed beyond repair? Do they just become part of the landscape?
That's what they do. Something that cannot be repaired and big enough that it is hard to evacuate somehow. We just take a picture of it and we're like, leave it there till better times. If I can see any Russian equipment that I'm not used to using or repairing, I just report the place to the infantry guys or the guys who are in charge of the trophy weaponry if that's not my job.
Right, right. I got to say, throughout this whole interview, Corporal, you sound more tired than in other conversations we've had in the past.
Yeah, but we had something like a tough couple of weeks. The Russians put a lot of effort to encircle the Ukrainian Armed Forces group in the city, and that means that we had also put more efforts than we did before to avoid encirclement. So everybody is a little bit more tired than they used to be, and the last couple of weeks were hard times for us.
Given that, what you've seen with this fight for Bakhmut, what difference will the battle for the city make in the war? Does it seem the fight in Bakhmut is worth it?
Every inch of our territory is worth it. I'm not a big general who is in charge of taking decisions. But of course, what we are doing here in the city is we're making Russians spend a lot of resources, both human and material resources, taking the city. And that allows us to plan counteroffensive operations on other directions. And I hope that will work out for the victory. If the army command sees the opportunity for us in the defense inside the city without withdrawing from it, okay, we'll do it.
What do you expect will happen in and around Bakhmut in the next few days and weeks, Corporal? What do you foresee?
There has been so much effort and so much forces have been pushing the line back and forward that anyone, neither us or the Russian army, can just break up. And it will be a disaster for somebody because right now it's like a chain that is spread apart by the really, really big forces. And sooner or later, it will break up. And I don't know who's the first who's going to fall. But of course, I believe that it's going to be Russia.
Corporal Andrei Shadrin serves in a military unit that repairs and replaces equipment damaged on the war's front lines. He spoke with us from near the besieged city of Bakhmut. Corporal Shadrin, thank you very much for speaking with us again.
You're always welcome.
In Thailand, two women are about to enter their 50th day without any food and only occasional saline injections. Their hunger strike is aimed at shaming the Thai government into freeing the women's fellow activists who are in prison. The women belong to a movement that wants to change laws prohibiting speech in Thailand, including speech about the country's monarchy. Any critique of Thailand's royal family can bring a long prison term. The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following the story in Bangkok. Patrick, who are these two hunger strikers and what are their demands?
Their names are Tantawan Dulanon and Orawan Pupong, and they go by the nicknames Dawan and Bam. They're in their early 20s, and they're part of this small youthful movement that is challenging taboos in Thailand, namely taboos about what you can and can't say, about the government, but also the royal family. So their immediate demands are to free all their fellow activists who've been detained around this issue, mostly for protesting about freedoms of speech. And that's about 16 people. Most are actually out on bail, but there are two or three inmates facing more serious charges, like possessing explosives. And the courts will not let them out on bail so far. So Tawan and Bam, the hunger strikers, are saying they're willing to die if their friends remain in prison.
What is the likelihood that Thailand's government will respond to these demands?
Well, there are short-term demands and big demands. So the short-term demand is to free everyone from this activist collective, including the three that I mentioned. I suppose that is within the realm of possibility, and then they would stand down from their hunger strike. The big demand of the group, Marco, is to reform a law that can hit anyone who critiques the royal family with 3 to 15 years in prison. And from what we know, more than 200 people have been charged with this law in just the last 2 years. As for changing that law, that is just such a major no-go zone in Thai politics. Suggesting a reform to that law is risky. Arguing to change the law can be interpreted as breaking the law. So the possibility of that happening, very small.
How strict is this anti-defamation law against the Thai monarchy?
It's extremely strict. In schools here in Thailand, kids learn that the royal family sits at the pinnacle of Thai society and they are above questioning. And this law enshrines that idea that there is an elected government in Thailand that citizens can critique within reason. But floating way above that is the king, the official head of state. And just to speak about the monarchy here in Thailand, Marco, you're supposed to use a special language, a special vernacular that is very fancy and very ornate. It is not like the UK where people are gossiping freely. So these two hunger strikers, Bam and Tawan, they've been accused of violating this very law. Last year, they tried to conduct a poll at a shopping mall asking people when a royal motorcade comes through Bangkok and stops traffic, how do you feel about that? And just asking that question crossed the red line, and they're actually out on bail now for those charges.
So 50 days for them, it's a long time without food. What's their medical condition?
It's pretty bad. Doctors have said their kidneys could shut down soon, so they could actually die. The Thai media has been covering this, but very carefully and intermittently because of the sensitive subject matter. And if the women were to pass away, it could force a larger public conversation. But in general, the Thai government has done a lot to squash this protest movement, rounding up protesters, charging them with very serious crimes. And this hunger strike is really a desperate move from a group that is already under a lot of pressure.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. An American writer travels to Ukraine to dig deep into her family's past. A century ago, poverty. Her grandparents would patiently watch while their grandpa ate.
They would just be like waiting for him to give them the crusts of the bread.
A history of hardship in Ukraine and new theories on what destroyed a gas pipeline connecting Russia to the West. Ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Cuba is facing one of its worst economic crises in 40 years. Yesterday, we followed Armando Guerra, a filmmaker in Spain, as he prepared to visit his family back on the island. Cuba is facing severe shortages in everything from medicine to gas. Armando brought two suitcases packed almost entirely with food for his Cuban family. Reporter Jerry Haddon picks up Armando's story just as he arrives at his parents' home in Camagüey in central Cuba.
Armando was hoping for some joy and hugs when he reached his mom and dad's place. And that's what he gets as he steps out of his rental car. That, and soon enough, a big dose of Cuba's current reality. At the end of that first hot day, Armando and his dad climb an old cement staircase to the roof of their single-story row house. It's a place to cool off after sunset. His dad grows herbs and vegetables up there in clay pots. We have to ration the water, his dad tells him, sprinkling some on his green onions. The water truck didn't come yesterday, he says. Is there also a water crisis, Armando wonders? Then, poof, the lights go out. Camagüey, a city of 300,000 people, is suddenly without power. The blackout covers half the island. Just then, Armando's niece, Claudia, comes bounding up the stairs. The government's turned off the electricity again, she says. Armando's dad puts down his watering can. At least there's still some daylight, he says, to get down. Blackouts in Cuba occur just about every day now. The country has traditionally relied on cheap oil imports for power. For years, the Soviet Union sent, then Venezuela. What imports remain are more expensive now due to the global energy crisis. The Cuban government can no longer afford to keep the lights on 24/7. The Garas head back down into the house, turn on the solar lanterns Armando had sent them from Spain. It's a drill they know well. Armando goes to the kitchen to unpack what he's brought, and he sees how since his last visit, his parents have been stockpiling food.
I see packages of chicken, grounded beef, teas and pastas. Let me see here. Oh, this is the canned heaven. Black beans, white beans, sausages. Every time they see anything like this in a store, they have to go buy it because they might disappear. You know, word of mouth spreads that there is chicken somewhere. Everybody goes there and buys chicken. You have to buy it for rainy days. The only problem here is rainy days is every day.
For most Cubans, stockpiling like this is a luxury, only possible if someone's sending you money from overseas. But one thing Cubans can't really stockpile, water. On an early morning, Armando and his mom hit the narrow concrete streets to buy some. They pass houses with crumbling facades, peeling paint. Out of nowhere, an unpainted metal ice cream truck appears, drives alongside them. Finally, they reach the one store in town said to be selling bottled water that day. After waiting outside in the sun for an hour, they get inside. But then the clerk tells them the credit card reader is broken and they don't accept cash. Is this their job, Armando says, annoyed, to leave people waiting under the hot sun? Don't take it that way, son, says his mom. But Armando's no longer used to these breakdowns in basic services, or the long lines, lines you see everywhere, at supermarkets and gas stations. Armando and his mom walk home empty-handed. On the way, street vendors try to sell them bread, potatoes. Everyone, it seems, is hustling to get by. The Guerras, too. On another afternoon shopping run, Armando's mom and niece explain. Anything that's lying about the pantry, we sell, they say. Even the rum you've been drinking at the house. Right now, they say, we're selling secondhand clothes door to door. You can earn an extra $5 to $10. Every little bit adds up, they say. Even the little extra that the government sells at a discount once every 2 months. A few days before Armando leaves, the food extra, as it's called, lands.
We got word that the food extra has arrived. I mobilized with my mom and niece to collect it.
What they're collecting is essentially a care package from the government. You pay $2, you get a bag, and you never know what's in it. Armando and his mom and niece rush to the distribution point.
There are more than 100 people here, most of them retirees and parents. But we don't have to wait long.
We got 2 packs of chicken, says Armando's mom, going through the bag, plus 4 cans of condensed milk and 10 packs of cigarettes. These are the good smoke, she says, like the ones they sell in the dollar stores. Armando's mom doesn't smoke, but the cigarettes will fetch a fair price on the street. Enough, she says, to pay for more food to add to the family stockpile. All these side hustles get Armando thinking of Leani, the hitchhiking doctor who bakes cakes to survive. One morning, he peels off from his family, drops by her place. He finds Leani in her kitchen, scraping chocolate shavings onto a pound cake. She adds some cookie crumbs, some small candies. She's precise, like a surgeon. When I graduated from med school, she says, I thought things would get better, but our salaries aren't even enough to change a floorboard in the house. I collect avocados and limes, she says, and sell them on the street. It's sad and painful to think that a doctor here can't even afford medicine. Armando buys the cake, heads home. He stays in Cuba a couple of weeks, accompanying his family on more of their seemingly endless searches for what amounts to, really, is some sense of security, whether it's food or medicine or water. Armando's been trying to help out all these years from afar, and they need him more than ever.
Me voy, que me dejan pelado. Me dejan pelado aquí.
Outside his family house, as he's leaving, Armando makes a joke of it all. I'm out of here, he says. You people have picked these bones clean. His dad says, hey, can I have your shirt before you go? Everyone laughs, which gives Armando enough time to close the door of his car and start driving away. And that's when the tears come. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
For months, there's been a lot of speculation about who or what caused some underwater explosions in the Baltic Sea last September. I'm talking about the Nord Stream pipelines built to deliver natural gas from Russia to Europe. You may remember the incidents. The latest twist came this week when the New York Times reported that a pro-Ukrainian group may be behind the attacks. But now Germany is suggesting that it could have been a false flag operation to try and put the blame on Ukraine. Christina Brezina, the managing director with the German Marshall Fund, is here to walk us through what we know. Christina, what is the gist of what the New York Times is reporting, that a pro-Ukraine group was behind the attacks on the Nord Stream pipelines last year?
The reports present a different idea than many people thought was the case when these explosions happened in the autumn. A lot of the attribution immediately pointed fingers at Russia, because Russia was doing lots of bad things with energy, with pipelines in the past. But now it seems that it's been hard to really pin this on Russia in the intelligence community. Instead, it looks like a non-state actor could be responsible. What is less clear is who it was, who they were working for, and who they might be seeming to be like or trying to imitate, which is why I think what the real answer is still is very hazy. The only real clarity is that there isn't currently any clear sign that a state actor was behind it.
What evidence does the New York Times actually provide?
So the New York Times refers to U.S. intelligence investigations, and there wasn't immediately a clear answer about who this might be. There was an investigation of a yacht that was rented in Poland that could have been used by somebody to have these attacks, but there is not much clarity on what the intelligence is publicly, and the sources that were talking about this were speaking anonymously. And even if you go beyond that, it's clear that the motivations and the exact methods are not fully understood at the moment. It is odd that we don't have full information about such a public and geopolitically meaningful act.
What about the contention by Germany that the attacks were a false flag operation? What's the evidence there?
Well, this is something that is coming out of Germany. Germany is a lead investigator here because, of course, the pipeline ended up in Germany. So their thoughts are quite important on the matter. They are also the ones that had the most serious economic impact because of needing to substitute away from that gas. Russia has not been participating in the investigations here. If Germany thinks it is possible that this is a false flag, I think that this should be considered with seriousness. Let's just say, Russia likes to accuse Ukraine of doing the things that Russia actually does in order to outrage the Russian people. When we look at last spring and Mariupol and the bombing of the theater or other atrocities that the Russians committed in Ukraine, those same images are replayed in Russia as an illustration of what the Ukrainians are doing. So Russia's playbook often is to do something horrible and blame the other party. Given that this is what we have seen throughout the conflict, given that this especially was the playbook last year, I think there is good reason to think that it could have been a false flag, but we really don't know.
How are other European countries responding to these various reports and theories?
I think there is a lot of caution right now in the response. I think there is a lot of concern about jumping to conclusions. A very important thing for all policymakers right now who are in the business of supporting Ukraine is to make sure that public sentiment still is on the Ukrainian side. If Russia had planted this as a false flag in order to undermine support for Ukraine, it would be very bad to blame Ukraine at this point. And we've seen the Ukrainian authorities deny any knowledge of or any involvement in this. And none of the New York Times reporting suggests that the Ukrainian authorities had any part of or any knowledge of these particular attacks. And if it is Ukrainian nationals in support of the Ukrainian war effort against Russia, it's going to be incredibly important to distinguish that from the Ukrainian cause itself.
Christina, I got to ask you, what about the contention by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh that this was a U.S.-led covert operation conducted with help from Sweden?
That allegation mostly results in eye rolls. There are conspiracy theorists or questions around, but I do not hear that theory having much credibility in the policy community on either side of the Atlantic.
Who is investigating the pipeline attacks and what information is still not known?
We have the Germans and the Scandinavians, the Swedes, the Danes, and the U.S. community involved in intelligence. The U.S. has access to intelligence that few other countries in the world has. And I think that understanding what thing that the U.S. was listening to, it would be interesting to find out if there are images of the people who boarded a yacht. If there is communication that is at some point made public between possible perpetrators, I think that would also be interesting. But in parallel, I mean, when something relies so much on intelligence, there will always be a limit about how much of this is made public.
Christina Berzina focuses on geostrategic issues in Northern Europe for the German Marshall Fund. She joined us from Washington. Christina, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you very much.
In state houses across the country, China has become a hot topic, from Florida to Texas to Virginia. In Richmond, a bill awaiting the Virginia governor's signature would actually prohibit the sale of farmland to Chinese companies. Reporter Jad Khalil of VPM News has that story.
Last month, Governor Glenn Youngkin went on Fox News. The host, Laura Ingraham, asked him a pointed question about China.
Do you have any idea right now how much land or business interests China owns currently in the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Youngkin didn't really answer.
Well, my biggest concern has been the fact that we have some of the most sensitive national assets in Virginia, notwithstanding the Pentagon, and we cannot let the Chinese Communist Party buy land adjacent to any of these national security installations.
The governor, concerned about what he called alarming rates of Chinese investment in farmland, asked state legislators to pass a law banning certain Chinese companies from buying it in the Commonwealth. And the General Assembly did.
Shall the bill pass? I-67 knows 30, the bill passes.
But even one of the bill's sponsors didn't really answer how much land China or other, quote, foreign adversaries own. Here's Senator Richard Stewart, a Republican from Eastern Virginia, presenting his bill to the Senate Agriculture Committee.
We believe that it's somewhere around 1.5 million acres, 1.6 million acres.
In Virginia.
In the United States.
Chinese companies and individuals own less than 14,000 acres in Virginia, and none of this land was purchased in the past 10 years. Nearly all of it, 96% of that property, is connected to Smithfield, which is famous for its ham. In 2013, a Hong Kong-based company bought the pork giant. Beyond the new law about farm ownership, Youngkin also made headlines when he blocked a major factory from coming to Virginia over concerns over the company's ties to China. The factory, which would have made batteries for electric vehicles, could have provided 2,500 jobs in a poor part of the state. All this talk about China in the state house has those who would advocate on behalf of Asian Americans in Virginia concerned. Suk Young Oh is a director of the Ham Kai Center, which organizes Asian Americans for social justice issues.
Last year, and in particular more this year, we started to see more rhetoric and in the 2023 General Assembly, action to really single out China as one of the greatest threat to the U.S.
Oh pointed to other bills this legislative session. Two failed in the Virginia Senate, which Democrats control. One would have banned public university professors from accepting Chinese-funded grants. Another bill would have banned state agencies from contracting with foreign adversaries. But the legislature did pass another, to bar TikTok and WeChat, which are Chinese-owned apps, on state-owned devices.
We see these and, you know, really make, like, you know, you just got to scratch your head, like, why?
Oh is worried, too, about what talking about China so much means for Asian Virginians.
It reinforces fears, racist fears, that non-Asians have of Asians.
Governor Youngkin has talked a lot about China recently. For example, in his State of the Commonwealth speech in January. After that address, reporters and politicians were asking why. Alex Kina is a political science professor at Virginia Commonwealth University.
Well, what's really interesting is you don't normally think state governors in their conventional role have a whole lot to do with international relations.
He sees presidential politics as a reason why Youngkin's talking a lot about China. Past governors dipped into foreign relations on the occasional trade mission. Youngkin's taking a different approach.
In today's climate, it's just sort of been reduced to this very simplistic view of international relations where China is just an enemy and you have to get tough on China in order to please the base.
It's not just Republicans pushing for this either. A lot of Democrats voted for the agricultural land ban. And on the federal level, Virginia Representative Abigail Spanberger is pushing for more regulations on China and agriculture in Congress. For The World, I'm Jad Khalil in Richmond, Virginia.
When author Megan Buskey was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, her Ukrainian-American grandmother, Anna, was a strong, reliable presence in her life, someone who watched out for her and her brother after school. But there was also something tragic about her grandmother.
She would cry at various times when she was talking about her life in Ukraine and Russia. And she would often come over to our house bearing all of this like food that she had cooked. She was concerned that we were, you know, not going to have enough food. And so I think there was something about her that was mysterious to me, even from a young age.
When Grandma Anna died a decade ago, Buskey realized she wanted to know more of her story. Buskey traveled to Ukraine, met distant relatives, and dug through archives. The result is a new book called Ukraine is Not Dead Yet, a family story of exile and return. In it, Buskey unravels several family secrets, including why her grandmother and family were exiled from their village in Ukraine to Siberia after World War II.
So my grandmother's brother was a member of the Ukrainian nationalist movement, and one of the ways that the Soviet Union tried to reduce support for nationalism, which was still quite prevalent in that part of Ukraine, was by deporting the families of people that had family members in the movement. There was about 77,000 people that were Ukrainians who were exiled on the day that my grandmother and her extended family were taken from their homes.
Right. So, as you mentioned, your grandmother's beloved brother, Stefan, was a Ukrainian nationalist. In the 1930s and 40s, what did that mean, being a Ukrainian nationalist?
The most important element of it was the belief in Ukrainian independence and that Ukraine should have its own state. But it also thought of that state, at least initially, in purely ethnic Ukrainian terms. And it had a very sort of negative perspective on the inclusion of other ethnic groups.
Right. Well, I think it's fair to raise the point that the Ukrainian nationalist movement at the time has a very uncomfortable history with Nazi Germany, right?
Absolutely. There was collaboration between the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists and Nazi Germany. They initially saw the Nazis as like their best hope for survival in this very difficult environment as World War II was starting. And so, yeah, there was really the belief that the Nazis would hopefully change things for the better for Ukrainians. I would say that the faith in that idea, you know, quickly fell apart. And there was a lot of animosity, if not like outright hostility towards the Germans at various points within the Ukrainian nationalist movement. It was very complicated. They kind of stayed connected, but also fought with them at various points, too.
Your digging through archives revealed some uncomfortable truths about Stefan. He'd been a policeman in Poland, and he was described in documents you found as a war criminal who helped the Nazis. What did you discover?
I did end up finding the document that showed that he had been subject to a war crimes investigation in Poland after the war. It showed that he served in the Ukrainian auxiliary police under the Nazis, which was a really bad thing to be involved in. These auxiliary police, you know, performed sort of normal police functions, but also aided and abetted the Holocaust. So he was under investigation for shooting a person that he had been charged with arresting and taking to Auschwitz. He was not actually found to be a war criminal because the investigation stopped. I'm not sure why.
How have you just personally been wrestling with that?
It was very sad when I found this information. I remember the moment that I realized I had been really like trying to find this document for such a long time. And it took me really years to get the connections that allowed me to see the document. You know, and I had grown up with Stefan being this like really noble character in my family story, someone that my grandmother loved really, really, really deeply. And so when I saw the photo, part of me was like, oh, wow, I wish Grandma was here to see this other photo we found of him. But then also just to know that, like, this person who had been such a wonderful, loving, caring presence to her had those talents put to these ends. Mm. That was how his promise ended up being used because of this, you know, this really, really, really difficult, horrible set of circumstances that unfolded in Eastern Europe during World War II. So it was a lot of sadness for him and for the people that he hurt.
These longstanding tensions between Jews and Poles and Ukrainians in the region your grandparents grew up in, historically part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, what were those tensions really rooted in?
one of the biggest contributing factors is just the fact that everybody grew up in an environment of extreme scarcity. I mean, I remember my grandmother telling me when I was growing up that she and Stefan would watch their grandfather like eat a piece of bread. They would just be like waiting for him to give them the crusts of the bread, which were like, she described it as being like candy. It was such a treat for them. And sometimes they would have to steal from neighbors to have the necessary hay to feed their livestock. I mean, it was really desperate circumstances, even when my grandmother, you know, was alive in like the early 1920s and the 1930s. Even though there were these tensions, there wasn't like outright violence until World War II.
Nothing is simple, it seems, in Ukraine. While you had one relative who helped the Nazis, you found out you also had a relative who ended up in Auschwitz, Josip Punko, your grandmother's first husband. Tell us about him.
So Josip Punko was, you know, a man in the village, my grandmother, and he married. He was an ethnic Ukrainian. You know, he didn't have any surviving family besides his daughter, my aunt. So I really learned mostly about the terms of his arrest, which, as I understand it, was for something like stealing a hat, some act of petty theft. And so he was arrested and sent to Auschwitz, was there for a month or two, and then was sent to the Mauthausen concentration camp where he died. And so by the time my grandmother was 17, she was both a mother and a widow.
What has uncovering this family history, your family history, meant for you at this moment when Ukraine is again swept up in such horror?
So for me, doing this work was a way to create a narrative for myself that was sort of satisfying about my family's origins. And also, I think, bring a certain amount of honesty to them in a way that, you know, I, as somebody very quite removed from the events, it's a lot easier for me to bring that honesty and that clarity and hopefully try to keep that version of history alive going forward. And I think as we look at, you know, where we are in terms of this horrible war with Russia, Ukraine is a very different place now than it was in the 30s and 40s. I mean, the amount of sort of inclusion that is being demonstrated on the part of the Ukrainian state today is just light years different from the sort of things that were happening in the 30s and 40s. But I also think it's important for a measure of honesty and critical stance to be a part of how people are thinking about what's happening now and a part of how people will be thinking about this war when it hopefully ends and hopefully soon.
Megan Buske is the author of the just-published Ukraine Is Not Dead Yet, A Family Story of Exile and Return. Megan, lovely to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.